So, last time we went into a black hole and we discovered some strange things there. That time going forward takes you to the singularity and there's no way out. And maybe you did a homework over the weekend involving orbits in black holes, is that right?
Propagation of light.
Of light. Okay, so I'm going to do a little bit more about particles inside a black, outside and inside a black hole, a Schwarzschild black hole. But really, Schwarzschild is not very interesting because Schwarzschild has no angular momentum. It's just a static, stationary. It's a static black hole. No time dependence at all, and that's not generic. Okay, because the way black holes form is that stars collapse to make black holes. But stars always have some angular momentum. Because the way stars form is you have some gas, and the gas cloud collapses. And it's a very complex process involving magnetic fields and so on. But it's inevitable that when a star forms, it will have some angular momentum in the final state. And it's also inevitable that when the star collapses, the black hole will inherit that angular momentum. And so we're going to begin by studying particles in Schwarzschild, just because it's easy. But then I'm going to discuss the Kerr metric, which is the generic metric, the generic end state of gravitational collapse. It has angular momentum. And as you'll see, it's far more bizarre than Schwarzschild. Okay, so all the things Kruskal discovered are as nothing compared to what happens inside Kerr. Okay? So let's do particles in Schwarzschild. And we'll see some general principles which we'll use in the more general Kerr example. So let's begin with the action. Okay? As I mentioned before, it's easier just to start from scratch and work out the particle equations directly from the action, not bother with the geodesic equation. And so the action I gave you before is this one, g mu nu x dot mu minus 1 d tau. And I've set E equals 1. Okay, so that, remember, we considered the action, which was a function of E and X, and we varied with respect to E and X, and we got the condition G mu nu, X dot mu equals minus 1. That came from varying the action with respect to E. But when we varied with respect to X, we got the geodesic equation. Okay? So, I'm just going to save a bit of algebra, I'm just going to set E equals 1 straight away and vary this with respect to X to get the orbits. And if you're worried about that, then just check it yourself. But you could do the whole thing with E not equals 1 and you'll end up with the same result. So all we have to do is work this out for the Schwarzschild metric. But this is just g mu nu dx mu dx nu, right, divided by d tau squared. And you see, sorry, E equals 1 means that d lambda equals d tau, because d tau was equal to d lambda E. Because that was the definition of tau. So all I have to do is look at this thing, g mu nu dx mu dx nu, and substitute in the Schwarzschild line element. And so I get minus 1 minus rs over r t dot squared plus 1 minus rs over r minus 1 dr squared. And remember that rs is the Schwarzschild radius, was equal to 2gm over c squared. Plus r squared theta dot squared.
You should have r dot squared.
Thank you. R dot squared theta dot squared plus sine squared theta phi dot squared. Okay, so I just put the Schwarzschild line element in there. And so that's the action. And the minus one, I can put it in, doesn't make any difference to anything. It doesn't enter into the equations of motion. It doesn't affect the equations of motion. So now I vary with respect to theta. This funny notation of delta s over delta theta indicates mathematically a functional derivative. Okay? Now I don't need to use all that, so I'm just going to vary s and figure out the coefficient of delta theta. That's really what this means. Okay? S is some integral of something d tau. And so delta s delta theta will be it's a function of theta and theta dot d tau. The functional derivative is basically d tau delta theta, and then you have two terms. You have df d theta minus d by d. Let me not get into it. It's the coefficient of delta theta. The variation of delta s is the delta theta times something, and this thing, by definition, is the functional derivative. Okay, so varying with respect to theta, we get the following equation, that r squared theta dot dot, this is of course just Lagrange's equation, d by dt dl d theta dot, is equal to d Lagrangian by d theta, which is r squared sine theta cos phi dot squared. Is everybody happy with that? How many of you have done Lagrangian mechanics? Most of you. Good. Okay. So varying with respect to theta, I get this equation.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I cannot see the bottom because it's a bit of a little.
This?
Yeah.
I was just going on a diversion, which is actually not necessary. So don't worry about it. Okay, so let me just write this. Delta S is good. When I vary the action, I vary everything inside it, and I get something times delta theta, and then I get something times delta phi, and I get something times delta R, and I get something times delta T. And this something here, by definition, is the functional derivative of the action with respect to theta, and likewise for all of them. Okay, so actually we write delta s delta theta is equal to, it's going to be minus this plus that, probably with a factor of m. Okay, and I get a factor of 2 from each of those terms. Minus sign, because here I had to integrate by parts. I get the delta theta and integrate by parts. Factor of 2 cancels the 2 there. And so this equals 0. So this is an easy equation to solve, because just think about it. I've got spherical symmetry, okay? And so if a particle is at theta equals pi over 2, then it just remains there, right? It's just going around the equator. And so you could see that if theta is pi over 2, cos theta is 0, and theta dot is 0, if theta is constant, so this solved. So this is solved. So we just solve this by theta equals pi over 2, by setting theta equals pi over 2. Okay, and in fact, that is the general case, because any orbit is going to go around a great circle, and by rotating that circle, I can put it wherever I like. So in fact, that is the general case. So as far as all the angular dependence goes, you can just set theta equals pi over 2 and solve the remaining equations. Now, the next Now, we want to work out the equations you get by varying with respect to r and t. But the first point to notice is that the Lagrangian, remember the action is the integral of the Lagrangian times the time, over the time. And the Lagrangian is independent of t or phi. Okay, there's no phi or r or t dependence in there. It depends on t dot, but not on t. And phi dot, but not phi. Whenever that happens, you get a conservation law. So you get a conserved energy. And what's the conservation law corresponding to phi independence?
Angular momentum.
Okay. So I mentioned last time that was the discovery of Emmy Noether in the 20s. That anytime you have a symmetry of a Lagrangian, you have to get a conserved quantity. And energy corresponds to the conserved quantity associated with shifting time, invariance under translation of time, and angular momentum under translation of phi. And so, and in this context, it's easy to see because the Lagrangian equations are just dl dx mu equals d by d tau of dl dx dot mu. Okay? And so this, so if dl dx mu is 0, that means that this is conserved, and this is the momentum. P mu is dl dx dot mu. This is the momentum conjugate to x. And notice it has a lower index, not an upper index. Okay, momentum has a downstairs index because x dot mu is in the denominator, and x dot mu has an upstairs index. Okay, so the canonical momentum conjugate to x is constant if the Lagrangian is independent of x. Okay, so symmetry lead to conservation laws. So first of all, the Lagrangian is independent of phi. And so this means that r squared phi dot dot is 0. And so r squared phi dot, which we define to be, let's say it the other way around, we define the angular momentum to be r squared phi dot, and that's constant. Secondly, dl dt equals 0, and so this means that t dot 1 minus rs over r dot is 0, and so we set the energy equal to that quantity, t dot 1 minus rs over r and that's constant.
Are you using angular momentum and Lagrangian?
Sorry?
Are you using
I should have put an M in there, really.
I didn't mean that.
Sorry?
Well, I mean, are you using L for both of the Lagrangian and angular momentum?
Yeah, sorry about that. Let's call it L phi. Okay. Yeah, too many symbols in this subject. That's the Lagrangian. Any questions? Okay, so we have two conserved quantities because the Schwarzschild metric is spherically symmetric and time translation invariant. And that is enough to completely solve problem of how particle moves in the Schwarzschild metric. We also have the condition. We have g min u x dot mu equals minus 1. And so we have minus 1 minus rs over r inverse e squared. Okay, so I'm just substituting in for the line element up there. Inside the action, we have the line element. But use the fact that t dot is e over this factor, okay, and I guess I put an M in there. I'll put the M in there as well. Keep going. So then I have 1 minus RS over R inverse R dot squared. And then I have my angular momentum term, which I eliminate the L from. So I get L phi squared over M squared R squared equals minus 1. Okay. And this just looks like R dot squared. R dot squared is here. So multiply through by this factor and collect all the junk into one term. R dot squared plus V of R equals A squared over M squared, where V of R is 1 minus RS over R times 1 plus L squared over M squared R squared. And we call this the effective potential. Okay, why? Because this equation is just the equation for a particle in a potential V. Okay, so particle to solve the motion of a particle in one dimension in a potential, you just write kinetic energy plus potential energy equals total energy. So this is kinetic energy, potential energy, and that's the total energy, and that has to be constant. And so now we can easily picture any orbit by just graphing V of R. Okay, so to graph V of R, just notice that at large R, I can forget about this term, so it's 1 minus 1 over R. And at small r, I can, this one dominates. Right, this one and this one dominate at small r, and that gives me a minus 1 over r cubed. So V of r looks like this. At small r, I have the minus 1 over r cubed. So this goes like minus rs l squared over m squared r cubed. At large r, I'm going to 1, but with a little correction, minus rs over r. Okay, and then as I come in from infinity, you see I get the minus 1 over r. But as I get smaller, I get this plus 1 over r squared. That's the usual angular momentum barrier. And that's what turns the curve up. So this is due to the plus r squared over m squared r squared. But ultimately, I've got to end up here, the minus 1 over r cubed at small r. So there's a maximum, and the curve turns down like this. Okay, so that's the effect of potential. And this line is E equals 1. This is this line is V of R equals E squared over M squared. Sorry, I'm just checking something. I think I should have had a e squared minus 1 here. Sorry, in this equation, there should be a minus 1. And oh, no, sorry. That's wrong. V goes to 1 at infinity. No, that's correct. So just graphing V, this line is 1, right? That's the line when V equals 1. And so what you see from this is that if E is greater than if E squared over M squared is greater than 1, then the orbit is there are two kinds of orbits. You see, if E squared over M squared is this number, so you want to figure out draw that line. This is E squared over M squared. And there are two kinds of orbits. You see, either r is out here, and then the particle will come in from infinity with r dot squared equal to e squared over m squared, right? And v, e squared over m squared minus 1, r dot squared will be e squared over m squared minus 1. And the particle will just come in, bounce off the hill, and go back out. Okay? What's the other kind of orbit if E squared over M squared is bigger than 1? In fact, there are three kinds of orbits. If E squared over M squared is bigger than that value, right, then you simply come in and hit the singularity. Okay? Or you fly out from R equals 0. E squared over M squared is big enough.
Can I have one question?
Yeah.
The only correction of this potential to the Newtonian one is a term with r to the minus 3.
Correct.
This is only the only correction as Basil is telling us.
Yeah, that's right. The Newtonian one would be the sum. We'll do that in a moment. Cf Newton. We would have minus rs over r. We'd have the 1. 1 minus rs over r. Plus the L squared over M squared R squared. Okay? The cross term is the new thing in Einstein's theory. Okay, so if e squared over m squared is bigger than 1, either I come in, if it's less than the peak, I come in and bounce off, or I could do this. And if it's bigger than 1, I just sail over the top in this or that direction. Okay. So these are unbounded orbits or R less than R max. And so, or you can also have this this type of orbit. If e squared over m squared is less than 1, then you must be down here, okay? And so the sum of the potential and the kinetic must be less than 1. And so you're either stuck in here, rattling backwards and forwards between these two values of r, okay? Or you're in here, coming out and running back. So there are two types of trajectories. There's one which goes backwards and forwards here, and there's one, so this is bounded orbits. Or these other ones. And that's all the orbits that are possible in Schwarzschild. This is quite an interesting one. So I could just be sitting there. If you work out the maximum, you will see that that requires, work out the maximum of the potential, you could require, you have to have a non-zero value of L. And basically you can sit at a fixed radius relative to a black hole and just go round. That's a circular orbit. So there is a circular orbit around this black hole with a certain momentum. So that's one circular orbit. There's another circular orbit here, right, where R does not change. You're at fixed radius, and you go around. So the Earth is in an orbit like that, well, slightly elliptical, which is this oscillation backwards and forwards. It's because the radius changes. But what's the property of this orbit? If I had a black hole and I put it into that orbit, it's unstable, right? So either a small perturbation will cause it to fall in or run off to infinity. So there is an unstable orbit as well in Schwarzschild, which is not true in Newtonian physics. There's no analog of that orbit. Okay, so now let's just solve these equations. And so first of all, we just use Newton's trick. This is how Newton solved it. Think of R as a function of phi. Okay, so instead of thinking of the orbit as R of t, just think about R as a function of angle phi. And so R prime is dr d phi, and that's equal to R dot over phi dot, and that's equal to R dot R squared over L, L over M. And so this means that our equation, let's call this kind of master equation, this one here. This is our master equation. Let's call that star. Okay, so star looks like R prime squared L squared over M squared R to the fourth equals e squared over m squared minus v of r. And then the clever trick is simply to say that define u to be 1 over r. So don't solve for r, but solve for 1 over r. And then everything becomes simple harmonic oscillator. So if U is 1 over R, we get, you see, this is R prime over R squared, all squared, and U prime is minus R prime over R squared. So square it, and I'll just get the term on the left-hand side. And so what I get is L squared over M squared U prime squared equals E squared 1 minus RS U 1 plus L squared over M squared U squared. And now you see that that on the right-hand side, I will have a term involving it's not multiplied. It's E squared minus on the right-hand side, I just have a constant. Then I have a linear term in U. Then I have a quadratic term in U. Okay, so linear plus quadratic is just the potential of a harmonic oscillator. And then I have the cubic term, which is the Einstein correction. So this gives us U prime squared equals E squared over M squared minus 1 over L squared. Actually, it's just this. E squared minus M squared over L squared. Plus RSU over L squared over M squared. Plus RSU cubed minus U. Minus U squared. Okay, so I get the minus U squared from this and that, and the L squared over M squared canceled. Get the R, and likewise the RSU cubed from the cross term and the L squared over M squared canceled. So this is just Newton. This is a constant. And this is, these two terms are Newton. The minus U squared, so these two are Newton. And then the next term is Einstein, which is RSU cubed. So now we can differentiate this, d by d phi. And all I get is U double prime equals minus U. That comes from this term, plus RS over 2 L squared M squared plus 3 RS over 2 U squared. Okay, so I just differentiated this with respect to U and then dropped the U prime. So the constant went away. Here I just get the RS over M squared, the factor of 2 from here. I divide by it to get those two factors of 2 on the right-hand side. And so this is just harmonic oscillator. Okay, so I could just shift U by a constant to get rid of that constant on the right-hand side, just redefine U by a constant to remove that term, and it won't change this term. And so you see it's just a harmonic oscillator. It's not oscillating around U equals 0. It's oscillating around U equals this position. So oscillating around U equals RS M squared over 2 L squared. And from the picture, it's obvious what's happening. Okay, so I'm down here, and I'm just oscillating around this minimum. So Newton solved this equation. U is equal to Rs m squared over 2L squared times 1 plus E cosine phi. You see this term being 1 means that the angular frequency is 1. So U is cosine phi, solves this equation. And all this term does is shift U by a constant. All that term did is shift the solution by a constant, this constant. And then we've just defined E to be another constant, which is the ellipticity of the orbit. And so this should be familiar, that when you solve for a particle in Newtonian gravity, you just get the radius is 2L squared over RS over 1 plus E cosine phi. So you probably remember this formula from classical mechanics. But you see what we do here, so we'll say, so these two were Newton. How do we solve this equation? So this term is Einstein. All we do is we say that U0 is the term which solves the equation when I ignore Einstein. Okay, so this solves dagger. Let's call this dagger when we neglect Einstein. Correction. And so if we assume that the Einstein correction is small, okay, which you can see in magnitude it is, because if I compare this term with that, let's compare this term with that. The relative size, so the Einstein is RSU times smaller than the U term. Right? This one is smaller than that by RSU. Just take the ratio of these two terms. It's RSU. What is RSU? Well, that's just RS over R. And so that just means that if the radius is much bigger than the Schwarzschild radius, then the Einstein correction is small. So let's assume that. So we're going to assume, assume R much bigger than RS. Okay, so we're somewhere out here in this tail, going around at some radius. And so to solve this equation, you just take the zeroth order solution, the one that solves this term, plug it into here, and work out the first correction. Okay, so we insert U0 into we basically say that, so we set U equal to U of 0 plus U of 1, and we substitute that into the equation and work out corrections. So if I substitute in U0, obviously the first term on the right-hand side cancels the left-hand side. So all I'm left with is the second term on the right-hand side. And then I will have an equation that determines U1. Okay, so I get u1 double prime equals minus u1 plus, and then I have my 3rs over 2 u0 squared. Okay, so this is the Gibbs, the first order correction. Okay, so this is i.e. we have dropped terms rs over r times u1. Is that clear? So I worked out the zeroth order solution, plugged it in the equation, found the term that wasn't zero, used the equation to figure out the first order correction. And then the important thing here to notice is this is a harmonic oscillator. That's a driving force, right? It's a function of phi, which is driving the harmonic oscillator. When you drive a harmonic oscillator, what's the dangerous case?
Resonance.
Okay? So you see, part of this term is just a constant. If I take this u0, which is here, part of it's just a constant. Well, that's harmless, because all that's going to do is shift the minimum of the harmonic oscillator by a little bit. So if this were constant, if this term is constant, all it does is shift the new minimum of the harmonic oscillator by a little bit. That's not very interesting. Okay? The interesting one is when this term has exactly the frequency of the harmonic oscillator, because then you'll get resonance. So the only interesting term, and the one we'll keep, well, let's call it the most interesting term. You can solve the other ones, but they don't give anything interesting. The most interesting term comes from resonance. So if I square u0, I'm going to get a cos phi term, a 2e cos phi times that stuff. And that will act as a forcing, as a force at the resonant frequency. And so what you get is u1 double prime is minus u1 plus epsilon cosine phi. Epsilon is some constant. You can work it out. Where epsilon is equal to rs over 2l squared. 2l squared m squared times 3rs squared ellipticity over 4l squared.
Why don't we consider term cos squared?
It's not resonant. Well, part of it is resonant.
It's also cosine.
No.
From the frequency.
No, it's not resonant, because cos squared phi is, what is it, a half cosine 2 phi. Did I do that right?
Yes.
So this is double the frequency, and that has no frequency. So it's not resonant. Resonant force is when you drive at the frequency. Frequency is 1. Frequency of this harmonic oscillator is 1. So if I drive it at twice the frequency, it's not resonant. If I drive it at no frequency, this is a constant force. All a constant force does to a harmonic oscillator is shift the position. Doesn't cause anything to blow up. It's the resonant term that causes you to blow up. Okay. So this is the only term that matters. And the solution of this equation is quite easy. U1 is just U0 plus epsilon over 2 phi sine phi. Okay, that's the blowing up solution coming from resonant driving. If I put this into the left-hand side, the u double prime will create a cross term, phi prime is 1, right? Because prime is d by d phi. So the cross term will create a phi prime cos phi term, which will cancel this term on the right hand side. So this is the growing resonant solution. And there is another correction, which is a constant, but I don't care about it because it's not growing. And so then you can actually combine this phi sine phi term as follows. So u0 was, we wrote it down up there, rs m squared over 2l squared. And then I have my 1 plus e cos phi. But actually, I can get a phi sine phi if what I do is change the argument of the cosine to 1 minus 3 quarters r s squared over l squared m squared, like that. So that is part of the argument of the cosine. Why is that true? You see, a cosine of phi plus a constant, I just used the double angle formula, it's cosine phi cosine of the constant plus or minus sine of phi times sine of the correction. And sine of phi will give me this term, and sine of the correction is small, so it'll just give me that term.
Neil?
Yeah.
Is this the total u or u1?
This is, you're absolutely right. Thank you. That's u including the first correction.
So what happened to the phi in front of the sine?
Ah, okay. So that's what I was trying to explain. Cosine of phi 1 plus delta. Okay? What I've done is I've noticed that phi sine phi can be thought of as just a shift in the coefficient of the phi. Because this is equal, delta is small, right? So this is cosine phi plus phi delta. So this is, and that's small as well. So this is cosine of phi, cosine of this thing, cosine phi delta. Now this is approximately 1 because delta is small. And then I have sine of phi, sine of phi delta, and this is sine phi, but this is phi delta because delta is small. So there I get my phi sine phi. Okay. So this phi sine phi correction can just be regarded as shifting the coefficient of phi in the cosine. And if you sketch it, what it means, you see in Newtonian mechanics, the orbits, if I just look down on an orbit, they will be an ellipse. But what's going on in this shift of phi is it means the orbit isn't periodic anymore. Okay, that's all that's happening. Is that as phi goes from 0 to 2 pi, the orbit doesn't come back to where it was. Okay, all that's going on is a shift of the orbit. So phi has to go a bit further than 2 pi in order to come back to where it was. Okay, or another way of saying it is phi has to go further in order to come back to the same radius. Okay, so the orbit actually looks like this. It's one of these sort of Lissajou figures. Okay? It's so what you get is precession of the perihelion. Perihelion is like the largest value of r. And what's happened is that the largest value of r is actually precessing around the origin. It happens, doesn't happen at phi equals 2 pi. You shift the value of phi. So that was Einstein's discovery. And you can see from this that the shift in the perihelion corresponds to delta phi equal to 2 pi over 1 minus 3 r s squared m squared over 4 l squared minus 2 pi. And if you work this out by expanding in that small quantity, this is 6 pi times gm times gm six pi times gm squared over l squared, and this is equal to 6 pi gm over r naught c squared. So for a circular orbit. So to estimate this, we would need to know L and the ellipticity and so on. So it's equal to this for a circular orbit. In a circular orbit, you can relate L squared. So circular orbit, you have L squared is m squared m squared v squared r naught squared. R naught is the radius of the circular orbit. And that's equal to, so v squared in a circular orbit is just gm over r. So that is g capital M over r naught times m squared r naught squared. And so we can replace, so we can infer from this that for a circular orbit, L squared is just gm r naught. So I can substitute gm r naught in here, and I just get this formula. And I put the c back in there. So basically, this is 6 pi r. This is 3 pi r Schwarzschild over r naught. So we assume the radius is bigger than the Schwarzschild radius. And so that quantity is small.
Sorry? Well, that L there is only for circular orbits or for elliptical orbits?
Sorry?
Well, that L there is only for circular orbits?
Yeah. So I've assumed the radius of the orbit is roughly circular. Okay, so that is assuming E is much less than 1.
Okay.
E much less than 1. And that's a pretty decent approximation. I just want to get an estimate. Okay, so not hard to do this more exactly. And that's what Einstein did. And if you work, so but you can work out that number yourself for delta phi. And what you get is close to what Einstein calculated. So for Mercury, so what you can see from the answer is that you get the biggest effect if r is as small as possible. And Mercury is the planet nearest the sun. So obviously it makes sense to work this out for Mercury. You find that delta phi is equal to 42.98 arcseconds per century. Okay? So you watch Mercury for a century, and the total perihelion shift should be 42.98 arcseconds. In other words, Mercury is not in a perfect ellipse. It is slowly following. Perihelion is processing slowly. So Einstein worked this out, and the observations, so astronomers had worried about this for 100 years in the 19th century, that Mercury wasn't following Newton's laws. And they had a correction, and the correction was 43 arc seconds per century. Okay, per year. So Einstein wrote in his notebook, you know, my God, this is amazing. I got exactly the right answer. Okay. So this is really what convinced Einstein that he's on the right track. You can look at, we can now that we see so much more of the universe, we can look at much more extreme systems. And so, for example, the binary pulsar, the binary pulsar, this is the pulsar which Hulse and Taylor got the Nobel Prize for observing. Okay, all they did is they found this binary pulsar. Actually, somebody else found it. But Taylor observed this thing incredibly precisely for 20 years and still observing it. Okay. And, you know, they had to use, I think, 30 decimal places. You can't use standard Fortran, okay, which only has 17. You need to use double or treble precision for these observations. But they've been watching this binary pulsar for 30 years. And so the binary pulsar, what is it? It's two neutron stars going around each other in a very tight orbit. So this is binary pulsar 1913 plus 16. And the perihelion shift is 5 degrees per year. Okay? It's pretty dramatic. So in the binary pulsar, the perihelion shift is huge. They didn't win the Nobel Prize for observing that. What they did win the Nobel Prize for was observing the gravitational radiation from the binary pulsar, indirectly, because what they do is they observe this pulsar, and as it radiates gravitational waves, its energy diminishes. And what that means is that the neutron stars are falling down in the potential well, binding them together, going to more negative potential energy, and that means they speed up. And so you actually see that this binary pulsar period speeds up on top of this perihelion shift. There's a speed up, and they directly observe the speed up, and the speed up is precisely what's predicted by Einstein's theory of general relativity when you compute the gravitational waves.
Would the perihelion shift increase then over time?
It's a small correction. So there's this. Yeah, it's a different effect. So they are actually, so this shift is, they have to disentangle all of these corrections. I don't know precisely how they do it. But basically they plot the period of the orbit as a function of time. And what they see is this period decreases by a certain amount. And that's exactly what you predict if the thing is losing energy due to gravitational waves. And so there's a standard formula called Landau-Lifshitz formula for the loss of energy into gravitational waves. I'm not going to cover gravitational waves because it's kind of it's a technical subject and doesn't really, it's not so interesting. But that's what won Hulse and Taylor the...
One question.
Yeah.
If we would like just to do the academic exercise of computing the shift of the perihelion of this binary pulsar, how can we do it?
Just the same formula.
Yeah, but it's...
You just need to know M and R naught. That's all you need.
Yeah, but it's a system of two stars that have a system.
Oh, you just use the reduced mass.
Okay.
Yeah, just like in Newtonian mechanics. This is equivalent to one system with a different mass. You can do the same problem. I haven't tried to do that. Okay. So that's one of the other great successes of GR. Oh wow! I've really used up time. Okay, so I think I won't start the Kerr metric this time. What I'm going to do is just end with calculating the, little calculation. What happens if I drop a particle into a black hole? How long does it take to hit singularity?
Oh, we have calculated that.
You did that?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Fine. Then I don't need to do that. So are there any questions? Let's just have some questions. I won't do Kerr now because it really is, it will be quite complicated. Any questions about any of this? Yeah.
These 5 degrees per year, is it the year for the binary browser or year of the Earth?
Year of the Earth. An Earth year.
And what is the time of a full circle for them?
The orbit?
Yeah.
Well, it's called a millisecond pulsar, but that's not the orbit. The millisecond is the rotation frequency of the pulsar.
But it's the same one.
I'm not sure. I don't remember. I don't remember what the orbital period is. The pulsar, these pulsars are amazing objects that are stars just made of neutrons. So what's happened is that the star was burning by nuclear fusion. But it radiated away all this energy and then cooled down. So the pressure of that hot gas failed to resist gravity and the star shrank. So what pressure is holding up a neutron star? It hasn't got any temperature. It's very cold. What could possibly be holding the neutron star up against gravity? Gravity is always pulling inwards. Fermionic repulsion, yeah. So the fermionic repulsion, what force is that?
Pauli principle.
Okay, what force is that? Is that the strong or the weak or the electromagnetic or gravitational force? There are only 4 forces in nature. I haven't heard of a Pauli exclusion force. It's quantum theory. Okay. So quantum effects are holding up this neutron star. It's completely nuts. Okay. But quantum effects tell you you cannot localize a particle. And fermions, because of their anti-symmetry, are even harder to localize than those particles. And so quantum effects are actually holding this thing out. So you might expect, this is a very strange substance. These neutrons that are have some kind of pressure due to their quantum nature. And actually, they're all in a superfluid. Okay, these neutrons, you shouldn't think about them as particles. Okay, they're not particles. They're in this quantum state. Which is a superfluid and has all kinds of strange properties. So these neutron stars are really, really interesting objects. But one thing they do is they trap magnetic field. So a superconductor, there's an effect called the Meissner effect. You can't push a magnetic field through a superconductor. So this is true in a neutron star as well, and there are magnetic field lines which get trapped right through the core of the neutron star. And there's a kind of crust, so you might think these field lines could move around on the surface, but they can't because the neutron star has a crust which stabilizes the position of the flux. So if you take this object and then you spin it around some axis, so they have very strong magnetic fields. The strong magnetic fields trap charged particles like electrons, so they're spinning around these. And these then radiate, okay, so there'll be some radiation coming out of this object. Now if you spin it around this axis, then it's like a lighthouse, okay, so this radiating beam is going to sweep around, and it hits us every so often, if it happens to be pointing at us, okay? So the millisecond pulsars are the ones which the pulsar is spinning once per millisecond, okay? And what we see is a dit, 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 dit every time this beam sweeps across the Earth. They're really incredible objects. And so what Hulse and Taylor discovered is a binary pulsar where one of them, we can only see one of them, and one of them happens to be pointing at us. And so you can measure this thing in so these are the most accurate clocks in the universe. Okay, in other words, this binary pulsar, it's a huge object. Okay, and it's just spinning. It just has angular momentum and it's spinning. And so the precision of these pulses is around the same accuracy as the most accurate atomic clocks that we have.
What degree of magnitude has a decrease in due to binary pulsar?
What degree of?
A change in period due to binary.
Due to the other guy?
Yeah.
Almost nothing. So so the other guy has very little influence on its period. They're close, so they're swishing around. But the other guy, it's spinning much, much faster. I don't know what the period is. Maybe it's 100 seconds or something like that, this orbital period. But as far as I know, there's very little influence of the other guy on the intrinsic period. There are shifts in the period of this pulsar. And over the last 30 years, people have tried to understand those shifts. Some of them may be due to the magnetic field lines creeping through the surface crust. So so basically you measure this T, and part of it is the, the T is the orbital period. You measure this the frequency of the pulsar, and then they try to make theories for what is causing the shifts. Now, shifts are very hard to measure, so typically they have to have several atomic clocks on Earth, put them all together and average the time to get something really accurate, and then you compare it to this guy. There are some deviations. But one of the most exciting projects now being done, actually, is called nanograv. So what is nanograv? So nanograv, you look for these binary pulsars. Okay, they're very rare. This one was the only one. Nanograv, you just need pulsars. You don't need a binary pulsar. Just need a pulsar, but you need it to be pointing at us so we can see it. Rather few pulsars were known until 10 years ago. I mean, they just had a handful. But due to much bigger searches now, they're discovering pulsars all the time. So I don't know the numbers, but it may be 1,000 are known. And then there's a radio telescope coming called the Square Kilometer Array, which will find 100,000 pulsars. So we will have lots of them. So the idea of nanograv is the following. Here's our galaxy, and we sit here, and we look for a bunch of neutron stars around us, okay, in all directions. And now we're going to use this as a big gravitational wave detector. So a gravitational wave comes along here, and it will move some of them inwards and some of them outwards. And that will cause a Doppler shift in the frequency of the pulsar. Because if it's moving towards us, we'll see its frequency go up. And if it moves away, it'll go down. So you look for all this. And there was a breakthrough 3 years ago where the biggest obstacle to doing this was the interstellar medium. The interstellar medium has ions and electrons in it. So if you send a radio wave through it, that can cause a change in the time, in the arrival time. Because basically the pulsar is emitting something. But if in one direction there's more, you know, ions, then the speed of light will be slower than in some other direction. And that itself would cause a difference between these different directions. And they didn't know how to compensate for that. But what happened 3 years ago is somebody figured out how to completely remove that effect, just by fitting it out with the data. The reason is that you've got radio waves at many frequencies, not just one, and you can combine all of them. And actually, there's enough information to completely remove this effect. So this was a great discovery. And due to that discovery, now they believe they can calibrate these neutron stars very accurately as a gigantic gravitational wave detector. So right now, there is a race between this experiment and the direct detection, LIGO, of gravitational waves. And both expect to see gravitational waves from black hole mergers within the next 5 years. And we'll see who gets there first. Nobody's detected anything yet, okay? But we do expect to see gravitational waves coming from black hole mergers. And you're lucky to be at Perimeter because this is one of the world centers for this kind of research. We have Luis Lehner and Latham Boyle and Avery Broderick, and they're all experts in this kind of thing. So when it happens, if you stay around, you'll hear about it. Any other questions?
I have a question according to the perihelion shift again.
Yeah.
In fact, we see we can observe a greater shift due
right.
to other perturbations.
Yes. I didn't mention that.
Yeah.
But you're absolutely right. Go ahead.
And I have never understood how to calculate these perturbations from knowledge about the solar system.
Ah, okay.
Is there a good literature you can recommend?
Yeah,
there?
There's
this
a exponentially large literature. But the point you're making, this 43 arc seconds, it was not completely uncontroversial, okay? Because the actual, this is out of a total correction to Newton's theory of 5,600 seconds. Okay, so in Newton's theory, you see that the point is, yeah, the other corrections are all due to the fact that the sun is not spherical. So the sun is not spherical, and so the sun has a quadrupole moment. Basically, the sun is distorted, okay? So, and it's rotating as well. So you have this planet going around an object that's not spherical, and therefore the gravitational field of the sun is not exactly gm over r squared. It's got a quadruple correction, which makes it 1 over r to the fourth, right? So monopole is 1 over r, potential, dipole 1 over r squared, quadrupole 1 over r cubed, so the force is 1 over r to the fourth. So when you sit out here and you go around the sun, you see this little correction going like 1 over r to the fourth. And the question is, how do you measure the quadrupole moment of the sun? I have not worked on this. I mean, somehow they fit it out using observations. As we have, certainly today, I mean, satellites have been sent in right near the sun. So there's a satellite called SOHO, which actually went right past the sun. So that's a beautiful way to measure the quadrupole moment. And so all of that is measured with huge accuracy today. So I think in the 19th century, this was still a little bit controversial, but there were various ways of fitting out the non-spherical nature of the sun. But they were correct. But people argued about this. In fact, as late as the 1960s, people still argued that maybe this perihelion correction wasn't right. But you know, by now, these things are absolutely nailed down in a million different measurements.
So we can be sure that there are no other interactions between the Mercury and other planets that there.
Yeah, we can't be sure.
Effects are neglectable.
No, we can never be sure of anything, as you know. Yeah. We can never be sure of anything. But the experts who work on this seem to be convinced. Okay, that's
okay.
All I can say. And if you want to work on it, you're welcome to do it. But, you know, you always have to make a judgment at some point. I'm just going to trust them. And you have to have a sense of when you won't trust them. So at the moment, I do not trust the measurement giving neutrinos, you know, saying neutrinos go faster than the speed of light. I don't trust it, but I don't have any reasons, really, because they spent 3 years on this experiment. And they've really tried extremely hard. But nevertheless, I think it's likely some systematic problem will show up, and that result will go away. It may be right. If that neutrino result holds up, you guys are in amazing position because all of physics will have to be redone. Everything I told you is wrong. Okay? And you'll have to rewrite the new laws of physics that allow particles to go faster than light. We saw that was right in the beginning of this course. That would be a real problem for relativity. If you just see something going faster than light, that means in a different rest frame, it's actually going backwards in time. Now you get violations of causality. And so, you know, every single thing on which 20th century physics is based on just falls apart. So we're all in terror. Yeah. Any other questions? Okay, so next time we'll do the Kerr metric.